you know, like, these games have girlfriend mode as a pejorative. We made it our most hard, difficult mode.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We also welcome Brianna Wu. Brianna is a head of development at Giant Space Cat Games, as well as co-host of the Isometric podcast, newly on 5x5. Hi, Brianna.
Yeah. Hey, what's crack-a-lackin'?
We're making a podcast, and we're very excited about it.
Awesome.
Also joining us today is Amanda Warner. Amanda is co-founder and animator at Giant Space Cat. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, how's it going?
Things are great.
Good.
So our topic today is narrative in games, the story episode. So hopefully we'll get a chance to tell some of our stories that we love in gaming and stories about telling stories in games. But the first sort of thing that I want to sort of mention, and we'll definitely get to being able to talk about Revolution 60, which is the game that Brianna and Amanda are talking about, but I am obsessed with Journey. Journey.
Me too.
Journey is the game. Has everybody played Journey?
I have. Yeah. I have.
Yep.
Now, this is a game that tells a story with one. I always said it was a game that told a story without saying a single word. And then I realized in trying to explain to someone that it's actually really like the game is not about what you're doing. It's about the journey. And then I just realized I used the name of the game to explain it. And that there actually is one word. The name of the game is the only word, and it actually is a meaningful word. And so, I mean, you've all played the game. I don't need to explain the whole storyline of it. But to me, that was just such an incredible like experience to sit down as somebody who does not have necessarily the time to play through, or definitely doesn't have the time to play through 100-hour JRPGs MMOs with crazy amounts of grinding, and have a game where they've obviously focused down on they want to tell a story in, I don't know, it's a couple hours, like, you know, within the same order of magnitude as a film, as opposed to the, hey, this is a game, and so therefore it's got to be super long in order to justify the fact that it's a game. And to me, that's kind of like just the little kind of golden example, and that's something that never could have existed maybe 20 years ago, before the new DLC sort of era, where you can have a game that's, you know, a $15 game by a relatively small studio. Obviously, like, the Journey folks are still quite well funded for an indie studio.
I was about to say,
obviously, but they're not like a 200 person team working for, you know, 4 years like the Destiny game, which is the $500 million, half a billion dollar.
Right. Do you mind if I say, like, I have a very different opinion than you on Journey? I don't like this game at all.
Oh, excellent. Tell me
you
why.
You know, you have to understand from my point of view, as someone that, you know, owns my studio, has put together the funding for a game, which is, you know, only $500,000, and, you know, has navigated publisher deals and has, you know, talked to a lot of these companies here, I think I have a little bit of a different perspective on it. And I look at Journey, and I can't help but look at the content of the game and wonder how on earth they spent as much money as they did on that game. I don't understand why it took as long as it did to develop. And even though I can appreciate the way that they tell a story about a journey and rebirth, and I do think that's well done, I can't help but feel that that's kind of colored by what seems like a very poor production process from my point of view. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, well, my understanding is that they worked on it for about 3 years, and they spend a lot of time building things and throwing things away, which is unfortunately often the... Game development is sort of strange compared to a lot of other types of development where, you guys know this too, which is that you can build something that solves a problem. Like, if it's a calculator, if it calculates, it's a calculator. Whereas for a game, you sort of necessarily, it has to be fun. Otherwise, I guess you could have a game that's not fun, but like a sort of, like, your goal is...
The goal is to have it be fun.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think games are worse than most pieces of software with this happening of things getting built and then thrown away.
Sure, sure.
And so my understanding is that they almost bankrupted. They got like a ton of funding and then still almost bankrupted the company, or like basically bankrupted the company. Like I think on paper they were bankrupt.
Even after they sold all of that, didn't they go bankrupt after the fact? After having a hit game?
I think so.
In order to make like a 2 hour
the doors.
Yeah.
But it was beautiful. I mean, it's definitely, I definitely agree with the sentiment though that like, wouldn't it be great if you didn't have to? I mean, similarly with BioShock Infinite, like, and we were talking about this last episode or one last couple episodes, that those are both games where, you know, people, a lot of people who played them were like, wow, this is an incredible story. And, you know, it's whether it's a masterpiece or not, but like, you know, they're well critically acclaimed games, but both of them basically killed the companies that made them.
Sure.
And not just critically acclaimed, but you can kind of see the money up there, I feel like, in both those games. Like, I don't agree with Brianna. Like, I agree with the how do they spend so much money from a, like, philosophical standpoint of, you know, maybe, like, maybe they could have gotten away with a little less. But you can see where it went to me. Like, to me, the polish is there. Like, every moment of
that game. What seems like it costs that much money to you?
Just that every moment kind of works and is really well polished, and it seems to me like that has to mean they went over and over it and tried it again a lot of times, right? What I see in each one of those moments being so brilliant is that there had to be 10 moments behind that they built first that weren't as brilliant that they threw out
that
and
they
started
had to
over.
Scrap
that were only pretty good or whatever.
So the majority of the funding was squandered.
Well, iterative.
In the first iterations. Yeah. I don't want to say squandered. That has such a negative connotation.
You couldn't have made that game the first time. Like, sure. Making that game took that learning experience. And that even that team wasn't going to sit down and make a game that had that level of polish the first run through, right? And so then the question is that level of polish worth it? Is it worth spending that much time to hit that level of polish, even if it means, you know, you get a game that's twice as polished as another game, but you spent five times as much money on it, right? And then the question is that worth it? And I really like Journey, so in the case of Journey, I think it is. But I think it's a reasonable question to ask. It's certainly a reasonable question to ask as someone running a studio, right?
I want to be really clear here about my opinion. Like, Journey spoke to many, many people, including Amanda, who was for a long time like, Brie, you've got to play it, Brie, you've got to play it, Brie, you've got to play it. And I'm in no way saying you guys are not completely entitled to that opinion. It moved so many people that I know. I personally have a massive bias towards not liking surrealism in my stories. I like hard-nosed 24 kind of gritty character pieces. Characters are what attract me to narrative. So something that's kind of a little bit more metaphorical is just not a story type that I am personally that into. But beyond that, like you say, it looks, you can see where the money goes. Like when I played Journey, I saw a programmable sand shader that had a spec map to the sand, so it glistened in a really cool way. I saw a bunch of static meshes for bricks that were recycled over and over. I saw a scarf that had some keys baked into it with the animation over and over again. And it's, do you know what I mean? It's part of it. It's a game that didn't speak to me, even though like, I think it's great. It spoke to you guys, but it just doesn't.
I'm definitely with you on the surrealism. Yeah. In that, like that was my least favorite part of it. Have you played Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery?
Yeah.
It's a game on iOS, which is another game where a lot of people really love and it was very critically well-liked for anyone who hasn't played it. It's got this like very unusual sort of pixel graphic style, but it's not like as if it was done on an NES. It's like it's sort of postmodern pixel graphics. And
it's like a polished Pitfall.
Yeah, that's a good description.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that game I thought was really interesting, and like Journey, I thought the music was a huge part of the experience of it,
yes,
and probably where a lot of the money went. But the surrealism of the entire kind of conceit of Sword and Sorcery being like, you don't know what is happening and it's all totally obtuse. Like, you talk to a tree and it's like, the future will explode. And you're like, okay. And then you walk out of this and it's just like totally surreal, semi-absurd. Maybe it'll actually make sense later, but probably not type of storyline. And I totally agree with you that that is sort of an easy out that a lot of, you know, obviously a Journey was less ridiculous in this that storyline being surreal. Like, it was semi-surreal. It had something that was behind it, but it was still kind of very abstract. But I totally agree with you that that does tend to get a little overused in, especially indie games, because, you know, it's cheaper to have a nonsense micro story than it is to have a full film type experience.
You don't have to tell us that. And no. Like, you're talking about iteration. Amanda, how many times have we finished a scene after crunching on it for months and assembled it and played it
back to it
and said to ourselves and been devastated and been completely that it broken
was missing,
that
yeah.
doesn't work. And then we've had to like have this brutal meeting of tearing it to pieces and making these changes and making it work. So it hits you emotionally. How many times have we done that? Can you even count them at this point?
Not really. And and as we got closer to the endings where it counted more and more, like it happened more often where we had to like call the actresses back and be like, can you reread this, please? It definitely, if you're going to do the abstract game, you are avoiding that. But it all depends on the story that you want to tell. So you do hit it until you get it right, which I guess is what happened to Journey.
So for those who haven't heard of Revolution 60, it's a game that Giant Space Cat is building for the iPad. I should say building past tense, but it's shipped just about. It's just about done and should be available very, very soon as this episode ships. I will link when the episode does go live, either buy it here or, you know, here's how you can find out when it will be available. But you went ahead with this very cinematic style of a game. Do you want to tell us a little bit about sort of the story you're trying to tell? And obviously, without spoiling the story, what kind of what you had in mind when you were embarking on this journey and what you've learned telling a story in games?
So for me, Revolution 60 really started with a single passion. And this is a passion that started when I was a child, and I would play video games, and there were constantly no women in them. And what I really wanted to do was to create a cinematic experience with a powerful female protagonist, something that we'd really, that's so rarely done in games. I think Tomb Raider 2013 really captured it. I think a few other games have captured it, but when I look out there at the marketplace, it's invariably, you know, stories about men. And I really wanted to create a heroine that was really, really powerful and a woman that was, I just really wanted to tell like the most cinematic, awesome story with female characters that had ever been done. If you look at my influences, I'm a huge fan of 24. I'm a very big fan of, you know, horror movies. There's a lot of Event Horizon in this game. And I kind of wanted something that was this intense character drama, this intense character conflict between these women, where they weren't stereotypes, where they were real fleshed out people that you could relate to and even dislike in some different ways. So what you have is kind of this political, you know, kind of spy story of this special ops team that's sent to this orbital weapons platform that's malfunctioning. It's gone adrift over China, and China understandably is upset that there are, you know, kilotons of weapons above them. So
this, pointed at their most populated cities.
Right, right. So, you know, they hijack a space shuttle and rendezvous with it, and things go very wrong from there.
No story is complete without things going very wrong.
I mean, Amanda, you helped me write this story. Like, I feel like my point of view is pretty much out there in the press. Like, what did you try to bring to the forefront with this story?
Oh, well, I mean, when we talk about influences, I mean, 24 is a big one for you. But me, I brought a lot of Whedon to to the party. Like, Buffy is a huge, huge influence for me. And, I mean, I love all of his shows. And, you know, you can have the serious, but, you know, there's a quote from him out there. It's like, you know, kill everybody off, but for God's sakes, tell a joke. So I did my best to, when Bree and I were working through stuff, to add some humor to it. There's a lot of takes, you know, from the girls that came through while I was animating, that actually a lot of the faces that they pull are mine. Nice. My reactions to things. I'm like, it's just going to come through. But we had some really talented actresses that were able to pull it off and gave me a lot of good material to work with. So we tried to balance some of the dark with some humor as well. And
that's such a good metaphor for our company. Like, Brianna's writing all this dark stuff and then you're bringing in a joke. Like, that's a pretty good metaphor for GSK. Yeah,
I think that's really important when you're telling a dark story to have that contrast there, because way too many, I feel like film, like, definitely there's lots of films that are just sort of too monotonously dark and they don't get that either. But in film, you more often see examples where there's that fun bouncing back and forth in between, okay, the world's going to end, and then the jokes and little things that aren't even necessarily like someone tells a joke, but like something that's funny because of its, you know, ridiculousness or extremeness or something like this. Whereas in games, often they can fall too much into this monotonous,
the melodrama.
Exactly. Yeah.
I do hear what you're saying there. And I think if you play Revolution 60, it's a very funny game. But I just have to say this, that typically when you have all-girl groups, especially in kind of the spy genre, it is Charlie's Angels. It is Cleopatra 2525. It is totally spies. And to a certain extent, for us to tell a real story involving women, we almost had to go the opposite way of the trope very deliberately, because it's so often stereotyped as this one very narrow thing where women are allowed to have adventures together. So, you know, I think there was a real balance to be found there, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, for sure. So one thing that I thought was kind of interesting, I was doing a little bit of reading about the backstory of the game. And I noticed this, like, when, so I have a beta build of the game that I tried.
I can't wait to hear what you think of it.
I haven't beaten it yet, although it's a good sign that I want to know what the ending is. Like, it's obvious that it's building towards the ending, and like, I'm starting to become a little like, I'm getting a little nervous about having made decisions, and then I'm like, oh, actually, now I see this, I'm like, oh, I probably shouldn't have made that previously. Which is a good sign that I care about that, right?
Right.
But I thought it was interesting that, like, when I started up the game, it said, like, oh, powered by Unreal. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting, because you see that often on sort of AAA games that have been brought down to the iPad, as opposed to indie games where it's like, you know, sort of the scrappy underdog type story, you know, Kickstarters, and we're going to have Unreal Engine. And so I was kind of curious about that. I was reading about it a little bit, previous things that you'd said about it. And there's actually a cinematic scripting engine called Matinee in
that's
the
correct,
Unreal
yeah.
Engine. Is that what it was that made you decide to go with Unreal, or was that like a bonus?
You know, I have a philosophy. Right now I have a 2002 Honda Accord that is a decade old and has 100,000 miles on it, because I would rather have nothing. I would rather have just something that completely sucks or the best out there. And I looked at the engines, and I looked at Unity, and I looked at Unreal. And Unreal was a vastly better product. It is better for lighting. It is better for technical performance. It is better for the cinematic tools that we use. It is better for the FBX-supported pipeline. And I said to myself, if I'm going to spend 3 years of my life working on a game, I want to be working with the best, and I want to put the best product out there. So it was quite simply a conscious decision to work with the best thing in the industry. And I have to say, Epic has been an amazing partner for us. They've worked with us. They have helped with their technical questions, with licensing stuff. They've been fair to us, and I just have nothing but positive things to say about them. As far as the Matinee module that you talked about, I actually kind of knew it existed, but my entire job on this project has been cinematic scripting. And I can tell you without a doubt, if you're trying to do a story or a game type like Grave 60, there's a reason Mass Effect uses Unreal as well. These cinematic tools are excellent in the engine. So,
awesome. I think that's interesting. We're going to do another episode at some point. I'm always saying this. We will actually do the episodes, but an episode on game sort of engines.
Yeah.
And it's something that to people who play the games, they see the logo at the beginning of the game, maybe, if they have a deal where they have that logo. And then they play the game. And every once in a while, you'll play a game. Like I was playing Stanley Parable last weekend for the first time. And it's built on Source, and it feels like a Source. Like, I know it's a Source game because I know the technical lineage in that it feels portally, and therefore it's a Source game.
You can look at the lighting rendering and just tell right away, or at least I can, you know? Yeah.
But it's kind of cool that exists. It's a much stronger feeling than you get in film of... and I guess Nigel doesn't have the same perspective because you did like custom engines at Radical, but I've always been sort of obsessed with this sort of idea that I can buy a game engine and then everything just works, which of course is
that's not the way.
You say you don't get the same thing in film, but I'll bet you that film geeks are like, hey, they can like tell from looking at a movie like who the cinematographer was, and like, oh, did they shoot it on digital or did they shoot it on film? And like, I we can't recognize any of that stuff, but people exist who can, for sure.
Yeah, if you listen to them talk about lenses, like my eyes start rolling in the back of my head. So yeah.
Although for cinematic games, like I actually took. When I was going to university, I always assumed I was going to be a game developer when I graduated because I love games, and I was in software engineering. I was in computing science. So, of course, I was going to make games, and I imagine I would work with Nigel at Radical one day, and that was my plan, which went sort of right in a weird way, and but not exactly. But at that time, I took a film class, and like one of the things, it was just my arts credits, but one of the things that was in my mind was that, you know, games are becoming so cinematic, and this was this is more than 10 years ago now, that's crazy. This is more than 10 years ago now, and I was already thinking, like, games are becoming so cinematic that there's things we can learn from film, and obviously that does inform the style of game that we're making when it is so cinematic as that, you know?
Sure.
It's right in the name, cinema. Huh. So what other games do any of the three of you think are sort of watermark or just sort of important moments in our storyline of getting to telling narrative in games and the way that we tell narrative in games. And Mass Effect is one that you mentioned that I think is totally appropriate. And I love Mass Effect. And when you mention games that have a strong female protagonist, my initial instinct is to think, well, like Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3 all have a strong female protagonist. And then I realized actually that was my choice when I started the games, that the protagonist was female, and a certain percentage of people, I'm not sure what that percentage is.
It's about 30%, if I remember correctly, or 28, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's less than 50, but
yeah.
To me, it's just totally bizarre when I see the cover of Mass Effect 3 and it has some guy on it.
I know,
I don't know who that guy is.
Right.
That's not my Shep.
Yeah, exactly.
I think for me, Parasite Eve is this strange game that's been kind of forgotten by the universe.
I have never heard of that game.
You've never heard of Parasite Eve? This is a PlayStation 1 game created by Square in kind of the golden Squaresoft era.
Oh, okay.
GameCube?
No, this is for PS1.
It's the same era, and I guess, yeah.
Okay.
It was kind of billed as the quote-unquote cinematic RPG. And this was in the, mid-90s where, oh my god, they rendered CG! I can't even believe it! It's so awesome! And so they told this story. It was three CDs long. And you look back at it and see the renders are awful. They are so bad. But it was all about telling this story of like the mitochondria in your cells, like taking people over, and like Eve coming back to life and all of New York being destroyed. It was completely badass. And I remember, I can say badass, I hope. I remember playing that. Okay, great. And just being blown away with that. And that kind of idea has really stayed with me through the whole project of just wanting to tell a narrative like that. Also Final Fantasy. I have extremely strong feelings about Celeste and Terra and, you know, Ryda. So,
yeah, the Final Fantasy stories, I think, was a huge thing for me. I've told this before, but in like when I was playing Final Fantasy like 2 and 3, which of course have proper Japanese numbering that I don't know. Yes. But at the time, it's like, well, Palome and Perome died, and I was like, oh no! Like, I'm so emotional about this. And they were like pixel figures. It was before even it wasn't cinematic at all, but the storyline really did.
You know, I was bummed out when they died, but I cried. Like, I cried when Aerith died in Final Fantasy VII. Like, I wept, but I really cried at the end of Final Fantasy X.
I haven't played that one.
Oh my God.
I know it's one of the classics, but it's one of those games that's now so old that if I go back to it, people will be like, yeah, well, at the time, it was so great.
It totally holds up. Actually, it was just re-released. It's great.
Yeah, with an HD version, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I do look at the animation in just like the character animation, not the renders, but the just the regular gameplay, and I'm like, ooh, well, now I don't feel so bad.
Yeah. Do you do that too, Amanda? Because I look at their rigs, and ours are so much more complex, and I'm like,
yeah,
wow, Brie, you're awesome. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, it is a function of the time, things have advanced, but yeah, I definitely. Started to cut myself some slack. But in any case, yeah, the very end of the game, there's this moment where where Titus hugs Yuna from behind, and I just like started sobbing, and it was the first time that I was like, oh my God, this is a movie. This is, you know, I get to watch all this. Like, my roommates would make me wait to play until they got home so that they could watch the movies with me. I think that was that was a watershed moment for me, definitely. That and the BioShock games. Actually, BioShock Infinite has been a really big one for me lately. That so much so that I've gone back and I've started playing the first one and the second one.
BioShock definitely does some super interesting things with narrative. Like, they tried something that kind of hadn't been done before in video games with that. And you know, certainly the original BioShock, and even with BioShock Infinite, even though it riffs off what's going on in the original BioShock, it, you know, there's just something very unusual about the way that they tell the story and how it's, you know, how rich the world is that you're going through and how much of a sense of place it has. You know, that was the thing that really stuck with me with the with playing the first BioShock, is it was one of the first person shooters that really felt like a real place. You know, so often in FPSs, it's just like, all right, you gotta break into the abandoned military base through the sewers and then, you know, fight the giant monster that's inside kind of stuff. And BioShock was like, here's this really strange world that you have to navigate through, that's got such a sense of place and time.
And that you're kind of actually interested in of itself.
Yeah.
Like, eventually you see enough military bunkers that you're like, I don't care about this bunker.
Sure. You know what I think it is, and I've been keyed into this, is the ramblings of the splicers as they're wandering around. It's not just the usual, like, ooh, there he is, get him. Like, they're saying all these crazy, but like really intricate things, like spouting, talking about how like God won't forgive them, or like, you know, what you'd expect a socialite to complain about at a restaurant. Like, there's a depth to it to the crazy that you don't, I just don't think you find in a lot of the other games. Like, they put a lot of thought and effort into those parts and added in the music. The music is a big thing throughout all of that series. Like, they made very deliberate choices with the real world music that they included within the pieces. Like,
and the made up music too.
And the made up music, but like, yeah. I mean, I've got Billie Holiday and I'm singing along as I'm running through Arcadia Gardens. I'm like,
and they took that to the next level in BioShock Infinite with having the you know, the like turn of the century take on these modern songs
in a way that
also ties into the plot, right? Like the it's such a great like what the fuck moment when you're doing the initial walkthrough of Columbia there before any of the fighting started, and there's the barbershop quartet singing God Only Knows, and you're like, what on earth is going on here? Like, this just doesn't, like, it doesn't make sense. And there is a reason for it, but it seems so strange and like puts you off, you know, sets you on edge, and you don't really know what to expect from the world.
Yeah, why is this here?
And for me, like, that's the stuff that I love in narrative and games. Like, I'm not a big, like, JRPG, like, play for a bit and then sit and watch a 5-minute cutscene kind of person. Like, I really love it when you just play the game and the game's narrative is integrated into it, right? And that's why I love games like Bioshock. Like, Portal is like that, right? They do a great job of you never stop playing the game. It's just sometimes stuff happens that's part of the
that's pushing the story along.
That's part of the story that's happening while you're playing a piece of the game, and that to me, that's where like the narrative techniques in games get really interesting, because then it's not really cribbing from film and literature anymore. It's trying to do its own thing of like, how can we have the player be experiencing this story rather than just telling them the story? And I mean, it's not that there's not, you know, there's lots of games that do tell you the story in that way, and it's that's not the thing that appeals to me narratively in games.
There's definitely a huge change over the last generation or so of games towards that Portal style of giving you more and more story during gameplay. And so, like, obviously, if you have a very cinematic game like Revolution 60, you have opportunities to say, here's the story and it's happening right now. But in a game where it's like a more puzzle game or something, if you have a whole bunch of gameplay, like that's, you know, some sort of solving a puzzle, and then they put you into a cinematic context, it feels more like a sort of weird back and forth ping pongy thing.
Yeah,
and so you have these techniques where, like in Portal, there's some voiceover that's coming over a PA system, or now this thing where you find these audio logs, which is something that was Bioshock the first game to do that? That you find an audio log?
No, they cribbed that from the various System Shock games.
I think.
I think System Shock 1 was probably, I don't know if I played one before that had audio logs. That was definitely the one that brought it to prominence. And I think System Shock 2 really, like, all of the story was kind of in audio logs.
I do have to say this, and I hear where you're coming from about preferring the Portal and Bioshock way of telling a story. It's a completely valid choice. And yeah, I personally did not like Bioshock. I really liked Portal, but I do think there are limitations to that kind of storytelling. I also think it's not a mistake that it's not a coincidence that both of those games are basically first-person shooters. I find Bioshock to be horribly repetitious as far as the actual shooting mechanics. And I think with a game like ours that is all about character relationships and making you feel and love these characters, I think there's just a certain limit to how much you can do with, you know, VO, or having an occasional scene where it cuts to your first person point of view and you're seeing this other character interacting with you. So I hear what you're saying. I don't think it's the only answer. I think it's a tool.
Yeah, it's definitely not.
Yeah.
One thing I thought was interesting about what little I played of the game, since it was on Alan's iPad, I only played it for about 10 or 15 minutes, is it seemed like part of the gameplay was playing the story, right? That anytime you're in one of these story cutscenes, you've got these choices to make about how you're going to respond, and that there are things that happen as a result of that. Now, I don't know if I got a good picture of what exactly goes on there, because I just played a tiny little slice and not even from the beginning of the game, because Alan had already played a little bit into it. But, it seems like it's got that sense of, you feel like your choices are kind of changing the narrative and changing how your character thinks about things, and that you're playing the narrative to some degree. Whereas that's something that's actually fairly unusual in games, like that most certainly most action-oriented games, like most first-person shooters or third-person action kind of games, like, the, you know, even when the story is not just on a rail, it's, you know, it's more like branching paths. Like, you, Ryan, you know, you go the way that you're going to go, and, you know, you do the things in the order that you're going to do it. It's something like an open world game that can be done out of order. But each little chunk of story is just kind of, when you get to that part of the game, you see that chunk of story, and then,
yeah,
and then you move on. Whereas the RPG style tends more towards the, like, dialogue trees, and, you know, you, as you pick stuff, things are going to change. And, but even most RPGs don't tend to have a lot of, you know, that's not a key part of the gameplay. Whereas it seems like in your game, it is, like, that you guys wanted to have it that you're playing the narrative as much as you're playing the action segments.
Yeah, I think a fault of Metal Gear and also Final Fantasy is it's very much play through the combat portion of the game and then watch a 5-minute cutscene. Yes. We have a rule with Revolution 60 that you must interact with the game in a meaningful way every, you know, I think it was 30 seconds was our max. There are a couple of times where it goes up to a minute in a really strange situation, but we wanted you to constantly be like Holiday in the tutorial. Like, she has to roll underneath this kind of X-wing looking evil spaceship. Yeah, this trying to hunt her down. And so you do a roll motion on the screen, and then your character reflects that. And as much as I hate QTEs in a controller-based game, what we found really interesting in our testing was the touchscreen is a more intimate way of interacting with your game. It's why it feels more intimate when you surf on it. So when you are creating motions with your hands to kind of make Holiday do an action, it makes you feel connected to the game in a way that it doesn't really on a controller. So I think the result of our gameplay choices is it makes you feel more connected to the action and not like a passive participant.
And I think that's a huge, a really good decision to have made, that you are always interacting with, even if it is fairly low interaction as far as you know, you are watching the story unfold.
Right.
But making some meaningful requirement, you have to actually be the person who does pick that thing up, or who does shut that door, or, you know, whatever the behavior is. And Heavy Rain was the first game that I saw that did that, and they spend the first however many minutes one of the things that have
brushing you do, your teeth.
Yeah, you brush your teeth and you're like shake, 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 and it's boring.
Jason.
Yeah. Yes. But what
Amanda
things
had to animate every one of those things, by the way. So, and she had to animate when you fail.
Yeah. Which, if somebody's really good at, they're not going to see, like, a third of the game. Like, great. Thanks, guys.
I tried to do a couple of on-purpose failures, and Alan had started his game on too easy a difficulty setting,
Really?
So it never failed. It would just, every time I let it time out, it would just, like, give me another shot.
Bing.
I was like, no, I want to fail. I want to see what happens when I fail, but it wouldn't let me.
Yeah, I definitely made a mistake when I normally play a lot of games on easy that are action games, because I am often more interested in the story, and because I knew it was a story-oriented game, I put it on beginner. But I think what's happened is that now it's just the difficulty curve is too low for me to be seeing the failure animations. And sometimes I'm curious, like, sure, I would rather have this sense of, like, I really do need to complete this thing right now, otherwise, something bad's going to happen, and I'm going to feel bad to Holiday that I failed her or whatever.
No,
I don't want to fail her, but I want to be just on the edge of needing to not, you know.
So I have to say this about this game. We, a big, big, big problem in the industry, and yeah, I'm going to talk about gender stuff here, is Amanda used to work at a studio, and they were doing a playtest, and they brought in the people to playtest, and it was all dudes. And, this is very much the most common thing in the industry, is to kind of tailor your gameplay towards a kind of hardcore market from the very beginning. And what we said from the very beginning is, look, you don't have to be a gamer to enjoy a story. And, you know, women are, you know, we're 48% of the market these days. And we very deliberately, from the beginning, wanted to make this a game that anyone could play. So if you've never picked up a game before and you just want to experience an interactive story, Rev 60 is going to be perfect for that, because we have taken tremendous pains to bring people in that are just normal people and to let them enjoy the story. So our easy mode, or casual mode as we call it, really does mean casual. And there's a hard mode, like girlfriend mode, our most intense mode. By the way, like, you know, like these games have like girlfriend mode as a pejorative. We made it our most hard, difficult
That's
mode.
That's awesome.
So
I didn't notice that because like you say, most games are tuned to hardcore gamers.
Yeah.
I play a lot of games, but maybe I'm kind of bad. I don't know what it is. Or maybe I'm just impatient. But like if I'm dying on the same level over and over again, I just don't want to play anymore.
It's a failure of the game design. That's valid. No, that's yeah. And we've studied it so much. The person that balanced our game is Carolyn Van Esseltine, who is a genius. She did this for Rock Band. And you know the great difficulty curve that Rock Band has. So we are very conscious about not doing that to people.
It's very cool that you mentioned that, because I was just talking, we're doing an episode with Amanda Rosler, who works at Tokoboko, which is a kids games company. And I used Rock Band as an example of, I love that Rock Band lets you put a mode where for one of the instruments, Nigel's 5-year-old can play and the whole band won't fail.
Yeah.
And for him, he actually feels like he's challenged and he's engaged and
And he's participating with the big kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the point is to have fun. And that means you have to create different rulers there than just the typical ruler of the, you know, kind of male hardcore gamer. You know, like there are different criteria to evaluate that by. So, you know, we've tried to be very conscious about that as a company.
All right, I've got like... this is going very well. I have way more things left I want to bring up than I normally do at this stage. This is good. So one thing that I think is interesting in narrative in games, and this is something that's close to my heart as I'm going to admit it, I have run Dungeons and Dragons campaigns before.
Cool.
So I actually have run one with Nigel last year, which was a lot of fun.
That makes you awesome. That's nothing to be ashamed of.
No, seriously, I'm impressed. there's always a level of detail that I am incapable of doing, and I'm like, oh, you guys are so good.
it's a very interesting exercise, and it exercises my sort of desire to make games part of my brain. But one thing that's always a challenge is the balance in between leading the players towards a story that you think it would be really cool if they experience, versus making them feel like they're just getting like shoved along a path. Like, you know, if I have in mind that they should go to this town and talk to this guy and then get locked in the jail and then have to break out, but they just keep trying to find ways to not get locked in the jail. And I'm like, no, you're going to get locked up no matter what. Like some super being comes and just teleports you into the jail. Like then that's not fun for them. If they feel like they have no choice. And so that, I think that's like an interesting sort of challenge in like, you guys obviously are building a game where you give the player choices, and that's like sort of kind of fundamental thing to the game. And I, like I said, I haven't seen the final endings, but I'm curious how much they diverge. Do you have sort of completely unrelated endings, or do they all sort of share a certain part of the story? I mean, maybe I'm asking for spoilers that
No. I can answer this in a, well, so let me give you an overview from a studio perspective. Game development is an extremely, extremely expensive endeavor. And you basically have two choices. You can have a Bethesda game, which is a massive world where like the lip syncing is procedurally generated. People don't animate things out to you. And you can have massive choice and have this illusion of freedom with everything, but nothing's kind of polished along the way. Or you can kind of say, this is the way that we're going. This is the branch of the story, and I will animate it and tell this story as beautifully as I can. And obviously, you know, we pick the latter. You know, people always say they want choice in game. That is a function of budgets to a certain extent, because games are extremely expensive to make. That said, what we really ended up doing was asking ourselves, what is the truth of, you know, professional holiday versus rogue holiday? What's the difference between Jack Bauer holiday and kind of, you know, Paragon Shepherd holiday? You know, like, what is the essence of the difference in these characters? if you're going to align yourself with Amelia rather than Minuet, what does that mean? Are you going to kill this person? Are you going to not kill this person? And, you know, the way that it basically leaves an ending where they do diverge wildly, like what the consequence is going to be. You are going to have to wait until the sequel to kind of find out what the consequences of the actions are, but it does diverge wildly. I mean, Amanda, do you want to say more about this?
You kind of summed it all up there.
All right. Yeah.
No, I mean, like, as the game is going along, we tried to put in as many choices as we could, but I am, you know, one person, and we're a small team as well. So, I mean, you could branch and branch and branch and branch, and give way to scope creep and, you know, lose sight of your story. So we tried to, like Bree was saying, we tried to boil it down to the most important elements and, you know, take our opportunities where we could without forking off too far.
Right.
Well, eventually it becomes a boil the ocean thing. Like, we can say, oh yeah, well, with more budget, you can always create more side missions and things, obviously. But if you assume a certain budget, you're spreading that budget over however many forks. And so ideally, what you do is you give the player decisions that make it seem like they're having meaningful effect.
Right.
And I do this in Dungeons and Dragons all the time. It's like, do you want to befriend this guy or do you want to befriend this guy? And that's going to make a difference in the very short term. But eventually, that you're still going to be fighting the same big bad guy at the end because he's the boss of both of them, right?
Or whatever.
You have to find some way to merge the story back on so that you haven't created 10,000 stories that all suck as opposed to, you know, two or three branches that are all good.
Right. You guys were praising Journey for leaving everything as polished as possible. And I would hope that as you played it today, you saw the tremendous amount of love that Amanda put into the animations of the characters. Like, I've played this game 800 times, and you'll see Holiday casting a glance aside or wiggling her shoulder, and there's this immense amount of love poured into it that... Yeah, there's a reason people kind of compare Revolution 60 to a AAA game, because it is that amount of polish. That said, we created less game as a consequence of that. So, you know, we have a four-hour game. What is there is extremely polished, but there are a limited amount of choices. That said, you get 24 different ending permutations put into about four different categories. So, you know.
Yeah, that's something that's very different from... I guess, like, obviously, as an independent team, the idea of hiring out a million motion caption studios and stuff like that, this is, like, ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, even Journey didn't, I mean, maybe they had a little bit of motion capture, I'm not sure, but,
probably
like,
not.
Obviously not, like, the way that something like a Bioshock Infinite, and I hadn't fully realized the, like, crazy amount of, basically, money that's going into this until, and I guess I maybe knew, but it became more real when at the end of Bioshock Infinite you see someone linked me to like a blooper or something like that of a whole set of like just one of the many 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 scenes in The Last of Us where they had multiple like three or four characters all hooked up with motion capture for their face and their bodies and also like the objects they were interacting with and everything, and they were going through this thing and it was a blooper scene, and I'm just like, oh my god, like it was interesting and fascinating, but like that's just like so ridiculous amount of like, you know, obviously no indie developer can do that.
We had half a million dollars. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, Destiny has $500 million. And so of course they have more, you know, they can do a whole bunch of motion capture just for as a joke or whatever, some company Christmas card or something, you know? But that's like a very different exercise as far as like telling a story as like you're saying, actually hand animating. Like, that's, like, you are all the characters, which I think is really interesting.
Amanda has sold me over the process of this on hand animation versus mocap. I mean, Amanda, do you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, I know we keep talking about Bioshock Infinite, like, ad infinitum, but, okay, so Pete Paquette was one of the animators over at Irrational, and he was tasked with the scene where just after Elizabeth is rescued from the tower. Songbird, you know, crashes into them on the beltway. I can't even think of the name of it. But you find her dancing on the pier. So he did this nifty breakdown of his process. So they had the actress go through and do the dance and everything. And he then took that and animated on top of that. So the reason that particular scene has this life and, you know, she's raising her eyebrow and, you know, giving him cheek, that all came from Pete, not to discredit the actress at all. Like she did a fantastic job, but he then went in with his animator's eye and added that extra life and that, you know, that exaggeration that you have to in order to sell it. Like, you know, a lot of games, I think with BioShock, the character style kind of borders on a little on the cartoon. So yeah, it's even more necessary. Like if you're going ultra real, then, you know, straight motion capture, and, you know, really intricate motion capture on the face is necessary and works well. But if you're going to have kind of a partial motion capture, having somebody then go through and really sell the facial animation is going to get you that much further.
Yeah.
It's just the way that you have to inject life.
Yeah. Well, and that's, if you imagine like Disney, how they animate their characters, it's some of the most lifeful facial animations that you'll see. And the way I've seen the process, what I've seen, oh, by the way, definitely if you can send me a link to that, that thing of the animating Elizabeth on the pier, I'll definitely put it in the show notes for
sure.
People, because that sounds
interesting.
I'll
see like if I can find it.
But what I've seen of sort of how Disney does just their old school animations, they often will have, even all going all the way back to like Snow White and things like this, of they'll have a video of someone in costume doing something, like doing a movement.
Rotoscoping.
Yeah, and then rotoscope over. But the facial reactions are so exaggerated in order to really get the emotion. Or even like Bambi, like they took a real deer and they figured out how a real deer moves. But then it's the hand-done facial animations that really get, you know, compare that to the facial animations in Bethesda's games, which I remember when they originally came out with this, like, oh, there's this really amazing technology system that can generate really realistic facial animations. Ugh. It's like, yeah, they're just mostly kind of creepy.
Yeah, yeah.
it's creepy and it's disjointed and
it pulls me right out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You look at it and you're like, what is wrong with this character?
It seems kind of sick. I'm not sure exactly.
Mm-hmm. I think it really is what are you trying to accomplish? A Bethesda game is trying to accomplish scope. A game like Journey is trying to tell a kind of narrative that's independent of character. Do you know what I mean? Like, not that you don't care about your character, but it's not about the facial animations and the interactions. It's something more abstract. For our game, which is 100% about character conflict, there's really just one choice there. And mocap, which is fantastic for action stuff, or dancing or body movements, is just not the tool for the job for us. So, you know, Amanda sold me. Like, I really, it seems like every time I go to a professional conference, I inevitably end up with a bunch of mocap people who are very genius, 10 out of 10 smart people that really understand this stuff on a technical level. But at the end of the day, they're kind of engineers, you know, and I just feel like we tend to kind of throw old things out of the window far too quickly. So, you know, that's how we feel in our company.
In some ways, doing mocap is going back farther in how things are put together, right? That one of the things that I think makes Naughty Dog's games, the Uncharted series and Last of Us, so great in that respect is that they, from the beginning, the choice they made is we're going to do all the mocap on all of the cutscenes with all of the actors there. So it wasn't a mocap actor, you know, doing some motion and then cleaning up the animation and putting the voice actor's voice. Like,
right,
the people that they hired to do those parts are both the voice and the body actors for those characters, and they acted out those scenes. Like, they brought them all into a room and put motion cap dots on all of them and had them act out the scene. And so, in a way, you're going back to, you know, to like film yeah. or live theater kind of techniques instead of, you know, instead of like classic computer animation before, you know, before mocap hit a quality level where you could use it to capture that animation. And I think there's something to be said for that. Like, I do yeah. think that those scenes in the Naughty Dog games play so much better than cut scenes in most other games. And like, to me, my gut feeling is that that's what makes it better. It's not, you know, it's not that the writing is way better or that the acting is way better. Like, I think both of those are true, but I think the thing that takes it above and beyond, that it really feels like those scenes are really playing out, is that they were.
Yeah, yeah. I also think, like, Naughty Dog has a much more realistic art style than we do. So you know, in The Last of Us, I don't think it would really work as well.
Yeah, doing motion capture for your game that way would have been challenging. Like, okay, let's get us a couple of like right. like 35 16 35 women to come in and like them. The art style is very cartoony and exaggerated and over the top, right? Which means you need people that don't exist to perform those characters if you're going to try and do all this motion capture in some sense, right?
Not really. I mean, they don't need to be an exact match. I mean, I think the major requirement would be that they're tall.
By the way, I'm 6 feet tall and I'm pretty skinny. So if that's where that whole art style comes from. So
yeah. It's actually Brie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. You joke, but no. no, I mean, I think proportionally the major factor would be height. But in terms of like body type, not so much, not as big a deal.
No. Yeah. I'm being a little facetious, obviously you can, but there is, you know, there's something to be said of, in fact, even the body type probably isn't the biggest issue. Probably the biggest issue is actually the movement, right? That you can change someone's height and, you know, the scale of things reasonably well, but if people are doing actions that aren't as physically plausible on real people, which in a cartoony art style, people are going to, like, Revolution 60 doesn't go as far as like a Warner Brothers cartoon, right? But
you wouldn't
make like a Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoon by mocapping, you know, like getting an actual coyote and an actual Roadrunner in the studio and mocapping them like that.
Although
I'll have to see if I can track it down, about the director for Frozen talking about the day that they brought the moose into the studio for the animators to learn how mooses moved.
Reindeer. Okay. Yeah, reindeer is a little more accessible. A moose would be, Jesus.
They're dangerous.
Yeah, they kill.
So the last thing that I wanted to sort of touch on, at least on my list, is music. And we touched on it a little bit before, but I think it's really a huge tool that people underrate when they're playing games. People will play through a game that I was like, oh yeah, this game, you know, something like maybe Last of the Us or Journey or Sword and Sorcery or one of these games that have a really great, or like we were saying, Bioshock Infinite, that have really great sound and really great music that's key to the story and the emotions that you get out of it. But they won't have headphones in, and or they'll have to have it on mute or something. So they just don't even, in my mind, get the game. They're like, oh yeah, I guess it was okay. I'm like, no, you didn't even play the game. It's just all there in your ears. And I mean, obviously there's the technical sound design stuff of like, okay, well, if you're walking on carpet, then the echoes are different. But that, to me, that's a lot less interesting than the sort of the music and stuff like that. And
I worked my butt off on that. You have no idea how hard I've worked on that.
That was a very important aspect of our game that Brie really poured herself into. She made very careful choices with our music.
Yeah, I quite like the music in the game, and I was impressed for, like, you know, for an indie game, you often will get either like sort of this tiny little loop of something that's kind of like off the shelf or whatever.
Super repetitive.
Or occasionally you will get something like I'm trying to think. I guess this is what Super Brothers did, the Sword and Sorcery one, is it's one person in the studio with one instrument, and then they sort of play through a soundtrack. And when you're trying to do something that's maybe surreal, then that works better. But when you're trying to do something that's like evoking a sci-fi film, basically, one instrument is not going to... There's no instrument that conveys that on its own. So what was the process of getting that music together?
Well, let me take a step back. I have very, very unusual musical taste in the sense that what Amanda listens to, I don't know any of it. Like, I don't care about music that normal people like. I like any kind of music that carries a real emotion of intensity, meaning I really love dance music. I really love electronica. I love gangster rap if it's that kind of aggressive sound that will just make me feel that ferocious emotion. If I love movie soundtracks when it's like 24 and the world is on the line, or if it's like Final Fantasy VII and, you know, you're fighting Sephiroth and it's One Winged Angel, like I wanted that intensity.
Jack Johnson sort of sleepy.
Yeah. I don't want you to feel at ease when you're playing a game. I want you to feel the intensity of the character conflict. When you're traversing the station, I picked a very specific kind of spacey song with some dubstep in it because it felt intense and made me feel connected to the action. So my process over the last 3 years of putting this game together has been to obsessively look for musicians that have extremely good music and to either license that music or bring them into the studio to do stuff for us, to work with them one-on-one. It has been a tremendous battle. And there are any number of things I did with this game that I think I succeeded at. I think the dialogue is punchy. I think our sets are cool. But I think the music is one of the things I'm proudest of.
Yeah, I like the music. Nigel, when I was showing him, he was playing through the game a bit. One of the other programmers at Steam Clock overheard, and he couldn't see the game, but he could just hear the music. And he's like, wow, that game sounds pretty epic. Like, he was just from hearing it. So that's a good sign.
That didn't happen serendipitously. I also have to say,
to be epic.
Yeah, I did. And our voice actresses, I worked my butt off casting them. We hired professionals and we spent a lot of money on professionals. Mary of Harrington, she's done stuff for Disney over and over again. Like, she's wonderful. We have Amanda Wynn Lee, who did Ray from, how do you say it, Amanda? Is it Evangelion? I still don't know how to say that after all.
No, and she even told us, and I still don't. I always say Evangelion.
No, I think it's Evangelion. I haven't seen it, but I've heard enough people.
It's a classic.
About it
that, it's a classic. It's wonderful. Classic. It's wonderful. We also, like, sound design is your voice acting. So we worked our butts off to get really good performances. Our Holiday is wonderful. I think we kind of started with wanting to cast somebody that, was kind of a template from Thumbshot from Mass Effect. And I think she kind of took her own wry kind of... How would you describe it, Amanda? Is it a kind of dark view of the world, maybe? I don't know. Kind of sardonic?
Sardonic. Yeah. Actually, yeah. That's accurate. I mean, Jill shines brightest when she's allowed to be sarcastic and dark. She really nails it.
Maybe I should be picking more of the rogue options. And actually, I've definitely enjoyed the dialogue for... Yeah, but I play as a Paragon in Mass Effect, and so I just instinctually feel like I should be professional.
No, don't do that.
It's probably more fun to be a jerk.
Yeah, but you're not a jerk. This is. We have a lot of talks about this when we were setting up Ref 60. Rogue Holiday is not a jerk. Rogue Holiday is someone that will get the mission done no matter if it's unpleasant for her or not. And that's a huge difference, that professional Holiday is truer to her friends and to what her job and her country kind of asks of her. Like, what is your mission as a soldier? Rogue Holiday is somebody that will get the mission done no matter what. If it requires a personal price of her, yes. If it requires a loss of a friend, yes. But she's not a jerk. If anything, she feels very deeply because she's been hurt more by that. And I think that's a huge difference in the two characters.
To me, it sort of feels like, and having gone through the dialogue, that rather than rogue versus professional, it seems to me more like it's badass versus like lawful.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair.
Yeah. I actually prefer the rogue ending is my favorite.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to start on medium difficulty, start a new game on medium difficulty and be rogue instead.
There you go.
If you put four fingers on the screen for the difficulty mode part and you type in unlock GF, you'll be able to unlock GF mode in your build. Like our final people won't be able to do that, but you can and play the really hardcore version.
Play girlfriend mode, the real hardcore version.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see if I survive.
Can you survive girlfriend mode?
I don't know if I'm tough enough.
Awesome. What was I thinking?
Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah,
I think we had a great discussion on narrative and games. I feel like there's so much more, but I feel like we've touched on some really great stuff.
Thank you.
We always want to know what our listeners think, so please give us some feedback either by email, hello@upup.fm, or on the iTunes store. And see you next week.
I want to know, you were the first person that we've talked to that has actually played a kind of final copy of Rev 60. So I want to know what you thought of it. Tell me what you thought.
Yeah, well, like I say, I'm not done yet. Okay. And I do feel like playing through, I also don't want to like spoil anything because this would make it into the show.
Well, how far normally, are you in? How far are you in?
So I'm on the station. I saw Nigel because Nigel played a little bit from where I was, which then I sort of regretted because then he inevitably is making decisions that I didn't make. And then I want to like, okay, well, what were the consequences of those decisions he made?
Right.
We're on the station and it's a scene where, again, like, how do I say without spoilers too much, but a number of the geisha bots are coming out and coming, or the geisha bots are coming after me. And this is like not the very first one you see,
yeah,
but
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
So we can talk about everything on the ship, like all of that's fair game. So, like, I mean, coming up through there, like, what do you think we succeeded? Don't worry about hurting my feelings. This is I'm really asking you.
Well, I mean, I think the final. I don't know if I can know if you succeeded until I get to the end, because it's very much like telling a story, and the stories often have that sort of like you're investing. Like I feel right now so far, I've been putting up, I'm putting like coins into the piggy bank of like, okay, I'm making these decisions. Like at first, like I was siding with the scientist whose name.
Amelia.
I was siding with Amelia initially because I was like, okay, well, it seems like Minuet's going to get me killed. And Amelia, who's like the sort of trade-off here is like Minuet is sort of like she's gonna get the mission done at any cost, and she has this sort of like sort of edgy, like she doesn't obviously care about me as a character, or doesn't care about my character, she just cares about getting it done.
Yep.
As opposed to Amelia doesn't want to die and seems competent and seems to be like a relatively cautious, and I'm like, okay, well, it seems like my gut is that if Minuet, you know, she's like maybe a liability, so I'm sort of been siding with Amelia so far. And I've in the stats of the game, I've sort of like filled up my meter of like there's a meter of how much Amelia is like sided for me, and then I'm starting to wonder, is like, okay, well, does that mean that now there's no point in siding with her anymore because I might as well fill up the other meter? Because like my min-maxer in my brain is like, oh, okay, well, maybe I should also do that. So then I started siding with Minuet in order to fill the other meter. But then I made a decision that then I didn't really like the consequences of because I didn't really fully, I don't know. It's always strange with the games when you have, you know, just after people say, I want choice, but then I make a choice and then I'm like, well, I didn't like that choice. I want to undo that choice.
Right.
Did I make the right choice?
There's something to be said for linear narratives that way. Like I kind of got that from the other side is, you know, playing the game kind of dropped into the middle of it and not really knowing what was going on. I was in this constant state of like, am I doing the right thing? Am I making the right choice? Because I don't know what the backstory is, and I don't want to screw up Alan's game, and I don't understand the choices I'm being asked to make. And I definitely was not well served by looking at like 10 minutes of the game in the middle that I feel like I've at least got to go back and once it's released and get it and play it from the beginning and get to that point and be like, okay, what did I actually do then?
Right.
I joke about starting again on Rogue and medium difficulty, but I think I actually will do that because partially now wanting to know what that little bit was that Nigel did, but partially because I feel like I would enjoy the story and the dialogue more, especially now with the bit that you guys explained. And also like that sort of you explaining it solidified in my mind. When I hear Rogue, I think of like making risky decisions and maybe ignoring the mission as opposed to, I feel like that Holidays Rogue is actually more, more along the terms of like doing the mission at all costs.
Yeah.
And so I'm partially curious to see sort of the other side of it, but also I feel on the beginner difficulty level, I was expecting more of what a hardcore AAA game considers beginner. And there's no way to change it. Or at least is there a way to change it?
There is not. It's just too complicated with the math.
Yeah. And then it's like, now that you've made this decision and then unwinding the skill trees and stuff like that.
It's a 4-hour game.
Exactly. So beat it and play it again is really what I should do.
I could tell you this. When people beat our game and they've made the wrong choices and they fail. And by the way, we fine-tune this math so hard. I mean, we didn't just pick a number and say, la-di-da. Like, we very carefully made the requirements for each ending. And, it's entirely possible to fail your mission and die. And people get...
That should be possible.
Yeah, of course. We can't make a game about choice and have none of the choices mean anything. If Holiday sucks through a whole mission, she needs to die. Like, that's something we have to do. You can't have something big without something small. You cannot have a victory if there's not a loss. And people get pissed. People get really... I read one transcript of a playtester that went through our game, and it was like, F you, and screw you, and you hate me, and they were taking it so personally. Oh my God. They had some other emotional problems.
Well, they were probably not playing on beginner too. I find another thing, and like it's strange to be giving you like bug feedback on a podcast. This is probably also not a problem. It's actually really the fundamental problem is that I picked the wrong difficulty level. But I pretty quickly could get it at least at where I am in the game, where I can stun lock enemies.
Yep.
So basically, they just can't ever do anything.
Yep.
Because I picked a tree where it's like, okay, I'm going to increase the speed. I was like, well, the thing I want to do most is be able to attack more frequently because it stuns them. And so I pretty quickly was able to attack fast enough that the enemies can never attack back.
Yep.
Which on beginner difficulty, chances are if someone's not, like someone's actually new to skill tree type games, they're not going to think, oh, hey, there's
stunning mechanics. Yeah, let me do the stun lock and then max it. No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm being a jerk to the game engine.
No. Like, you're not being a jerk. It's just
not to you, but to the game.
it's a very, very, very conscious decision that we made to be very inclusive to everyone. And
for sure.
I mean, there's a sense out there that female gamers are somehow less than normal gamers and or male gamers or hardcore gamers. And I wanted to create something that was kind of a gateway drug to hardcore games. And I can't tell you how many people I've had that aren't really gamers that have played Revolution 60. And they've said, like, this is the first game I've ever played that doesn't feel like a you're not welcome sign is hanging out in front of it. And they've gone on and started playing Portal. Oh, I'm sorry. What were you saying, Amanda?
No, or like I'm being punished.
Yeah.
For not doing well.
Yeah. So we really tried very hard to make it a balance. Like normal is challenging. Girlfriend mode is very hard to play. But casual is for literal casual players. And I make no apologies about that.
Yeah. Something that, obviously the game's shipped to the App Store already. So, it's all maybe next
week. Well, it will be next week.
It will be next week. Great. But the maybe something that would have helped me in my decision-making progress was that if there was a default level difficulty level and like an easy and then a very easy, which is often what I've seen in some games where there is a game mode that is intended for people who are new to games as opposed to new to this game.
Yeah.
And the messaging on that screen, and I don't remember off the top of my head, but the messaging on my that screen didn't worry me that the easy mode would be too easy. But that's also a trade-off because you can imagine, like, if you make it so that the default mode says tough mode, and then someone who's new to games picks that mode, but it turns out it's actually easy enough for them, then that person is going to enjoy it more because they're going to feel tough.
Yeah.
Even though it's actually pretty easy. Whereas, so there's like a trade-off in between. The more you signal to me as a gamer who understands gaming conventions that this is going to be easy, maybe the less satisfied somebody who is not as tuned to those gaming conventions will be with beating the game on that level.
Yeah. So, no, it's totally legit. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I hire people and don't micromanage them and let them make their decisions. Amanda, if she wants to make a animation decision, I don't micromanage her. I'm like, do what you think is right. Carolyn is someone we hired because of her immense experience here, and she wanted to name the levels what she thought was best based on her experience with Rock Band, and I just got out of the way and said, do it your way. So, you know, that's kind of on her. And, you know, it's part of running a team is you have to trust people as professionals. And I'm not negating your point of view here. I'm just saying that was our process inside the studio of deciding that.
Yeah, and it's also gameplay, right? Like, or big gameplay testing. If you gameplay test on 100 people and I'm the one person that says, hey, I had this problem, then even though it affects me, it's like not really that. And like you say, it's a 4-hour game. I can start again and maybe I will start a new one on the higher difficulty level. And it's like way different than if you're playing a 100-hour JRPG where it's like, yeah, I am 50 hours in. Actually, I regretted some decision I made. And even though people do play those games over and over too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm curious, what did you think of I would be interested in what you thought of the animation and the combat engine.
The combat engine feels to me, and I'm not all the way through the game, so I'm not sure if this is the case, but my initial assumption with the combat engine was that it was designed for people who, or like having multiple enemies and multiple allies on the grid at one time, which is normally what grid-based combat systems I've seen, especially in RPGs. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I saw that combat system, it felt like it feels strange, especially because the enemy AI will like dodge away from you when you can't shoot at them and things like that. But it's sort of like exploring its space and you can move around your space. But I felt like it was designed for multiple people, but I haven't actually had multiple people come into combat yet. Is that, does that spoil something?
I wish we could do that. We're probably going to do it for the sequel. This device has to run on the 4S, and I could get into a technical conversation of draw calls and rigs and RAM usage here. You do generally fight one enemy at a time, though there are some exceptions. So.
And then the other thing with combat is that once I upgraded to the point, and again, it's a problem with me being on beginner, once I upgraded the point that I can stun lock the enemies, then the combat system mostly falls over because I don't have to do anything. I just like just keep pressing the buttons. And
I have to say there's a point where that's not going to keep working even on beginner.
I imagine that's the case. So it's just where I am right now.
Yeah.
So for the combat, that's kind of where I am with it.
But did you find it enjoyable? Because it was extremely challenging for us to adapt. We didn't want to rip off Infinity Blade, which has been what half the studios using Unreal have done. And we tried to strike out in our own direction and make it kind of intuitive for a touchpad. Did you like that? Did you not like it?
I liked it, but it's getting, like, I liked first getting into it. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm moving around and I'm using these abilities. But it's, for me, as somebody who plays a lot of games, it's getting repetitive.
Yeah, and you need to pick up the difficulty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think I figured that out. but it is because, you know, at least where I am, I have two weapons and they both, at least the weapon I chose, I think it was a choice that it was like a double shot and single shot. Mm-hmm. They are mostly do the same thing. And I will always use one instead of the other. So I don't feel like I'm making a lot of decisions in combat. Mm-hmm. But you know, also we'll see, like play it on a higher difficulty level.
Yeah. On the higher difficulty mode, single versus double shot has some real tactical consequences. So it's like I said, we really tried to make it where it worked at two levels. Do you know what I mean? For first-time gamers to be able to play through it and not get the crap beaten out of them,
for sure.
And, you know, make it a harder difficulty level. So, yeah.
It definitely, I liked with the combat that it felt a little action-y. Like, mm-hmm. I was a little worried going into it because it seemed to be kind of a JRPG-influenced style of combat, and that's something that's never really appealed to me. Like, I'm, you know, I have played a couple of games in that style, and just that, the style of, like, sort of turn-based combat just doesn't do anything for me, whereas I like the fact that there was a bit of action and, like, the interspersing of the quick time events. Like, it made the combat appeal to me more than I expected it to in the game. Like, I was expecting something, you know, from just seeing like a screenshot of the combat or something like that. I was like, oh, is this going to be like another,
nope,
you know, pick all of your actions, and you have to have sort of deep knowledge of what the actions do relative to actions that the other person can pick, you know, like I watch my kids play like Pokemon or something like
right.
that. Right. You know, that like that kind of combat I find really frustrating as a gamer because I'm an action gamer. So it was nice to have that, like, yeah, there is something a little actiony. And I mean I was playing on easy as well, but I hadn't, you know, I got dropped into the middle, and so I had to do some combats from farther along, and I found it reasonably challenging, the combats that I did. Like, I definitely had to think about what was going on.
Yeah, and the other question you had was the animation. And
yeah, I mean, we've got Amanda here, so tell us what you thought of her.
Be kind.
Be honest.
Don't be kind. Yeah. Be honest.
I like the facial animation, and I would previously having spent a lot of my time talking about AAA games and talking to Nigel about how AAA games are made. I'd started to become a little bit like of one mind about motion capture, and we had a really good talk about that today on this episode about motion capture and its role in games, and how like it's one of the sort of things I think of as kind of like inherently better. But what you were talking about with the facial animations being hand tuned actually really shows through in the game. And so on the character animations, like the body animations for some of the action sequences, especially like in the intro and things like that, where it's like flying off the bike or like really big, big sequences where the character is going through a lot of physics, just because they're like falling or tumbling or something like that. Especially when I first started playing the game, it was really kind of stuck out to me as like, okay, well, that's not the way that I'm used to seeing characters animated. It feels more like sort of like a retro animation style, as opposed to like, to me, it made me think of like sort of PlayStation 2 era games. Or maybe even PlayStation 1 era, because it's just sort of the feeling of that hand-tuned animation for people, I guess.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective, yeah.
Whereas the facial animations, I felt like in some ways are more interesting and more engaging than you might see from motion caps. Like, what's that game that was the sleuth? It was like the police game, L.A. Noir.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, what a fail.
L.A. Noir. They spend this crazy amount of time doing all this motion capture on people's faces. But I often found that, like, I couldn't really tell what they were trying to, like, okay, is this person lying or not? And, like, they're trying to tell the actor, look like you're lying. And the actor's like,
Yeah.
Right? Whereas
yeah.
you get with a hand-tuned animation for facial animation, you can get that sort of like clear eyebrow is like twitching just a little bit. Like you can give me just the details that matter, and then you can give them to me in the very specific amount. And so I like the facial animations aspect of that, of it being hand-tuned animation. So that's cool. My kind of what I picked up from it.
I will take that.
We're trying to decide for the sequel if we're going to, for some of the battle scenes, kind of move over to a mocap solution for that. Because I do think, like with Holiday, like as we don't have her walk to the side during combat, like she jumps up in the air and flips around and kind of lands with her arms out. And I would be curious to, you know, at least experiment with some mocap and see if it comes out with a good, you know, result for that. But I think for the personal scenes where the characters are interacting with each other, I don't think we'll ever move to mocap. I don't see the value for a studio our size.
Yeah, and obviously it's a huge expenditure, and you get your pie and you get to divide it how you want to divide it.
Yeah.
I think the way I would sort of feel like thinking about the sequel and thinking about what I've seen so far of the game, if you were going to put some either put some mocap in, or you're thinking about how can you improve the sort of fidelity of some of the animations. The combat, like, although the animations sometimes, you know, anytime you have animations that repeat, you start to like recognize them, and that's just kind of what you're going to get in a game. But
sure.
For the type of game that is, that didn't really stick out to me as being a problem. I think the like I say, the times where it's the animation being done by hand stuck out to me was when it was the more challenging or complicated, like, you know, a Holiday jumping off of her bike and landing and these sorts of things.
That was one of the very first things I ever did.
Yeah.
For sure. And that makes sense. Yeah. Like, you're going to work through the game in order. And actually, I'm not entirely sure if this is my imagination, how much of it is me getting used to it and how much of it is the animation getting better. But I feel like throughout as I've gone through the game, that the fidelity of them has gotten better.
Amanda got a lot better.
Oh, yeah. I got better and faster.
Yeah. And you can see that in the animations in the game. And that's something.
One of the things that we always did at Radical was build the first mission last.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we'd spec out the entire game, and we'd start building from the second mission through, and then when we got to the end of the game, we'd go back and build the first mission.
And
so
you were all really good at building missions.
Through the production process, we could dump into the first mission and make it awesome.
Oh, no, that's very smart. I made the mistake. The biggest mistakes I made on this project was I love the opening cutscenes of the PS1 era that Square did, with Final Fantasy in particular, and Parasite Eve, which we talked about tonight, and I wanted a CG opening. And originally ours was about 3 minutes long, and people were just falling asleep, and it was a huge mistake to do that. We actually went back through and did the tutorial mission that you saw first, and you saw we kind of chopped it up into different segments. We will never do another rendered cutscene for Revolution 60 ever.
I mean, I think for the style of game that you guys are doing, like, mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the things from games from that era is that to some degree you got to kind of own that. Okay, yeah, it's not, you know, it's an iPad game. It's a game made by a small studio, and so it's not going to look like. You know, it's not going to look like Uncharted 3 or Last of Us. But with the cutscenes, you know, like, a lot of that cost goes out the window. Like, it's not that much harder to make a cutscene that looks really great. So if you give into that temptation of like, hey, let's get this like third party CG house to do our cutscene and make it look better, it'll look a little weird and unnatural. And a lot of games, even from the like PS1, PS2 kind of era, like, that was a big problem before everyone started doing in-engine cutscenes, is people would do those cutscenes and just be like, oh, this doesn't look anything like the game.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you're playing the game and then you're watching the movie that looks totally different. And I'd rather just have a game kind of like own its art style and say, yeah, we're just going to do our cutscenes in-engine. And maybe it won't look as good as if we outsource it, and we won't be able to do as much cool stuff as if we did it all CG, but then it feels like part of the game as opposed to being something you got to switch over into the other mode to do.
No, I think that's very legit, and that's what we're going to do for our sequel. Another thing that's worth saying is, yeah, now it's 3 years later and Apple devices are far more powerful. So I think it's got, like, when we were planning this game, the iPad 2 hadn't even come out when we were designing our characters. So there's been a huge evolution of how much power is available on the platform. So, you know, like, I have no doubt for the sequel that if we're limiting ourselves to, you know, roughly the iPhone 5 and above, that we're going to be fine, you know, as far as power to create it in game.
When you started, the iPad 2 didn't exist, and now it's that slow device that you have to support because,
you guys have done game dev work. Do you know much about engine stuff? Because I could have an hour long crying session about the 512 memory of the iPad 2.
Well, we do. Yeah. We run an iOS development shop called Steam Clock, and we are dealing with these devices that Apple has been selling, the iPad Mini, and they've been selling the iPad 2 in giant quantities, and people never replaced their iPads.
iPad 2 era hardware is going to be a big albatross around the neck of the game dev community, because like more than 50% of the iPads that are out there are basically iPad 2s, because the iPad Mini's just an iPad 2 with a smaller screen, essentially.
Yeah.
So It's rough that
that 512, and then iOS 7 came out and chewed up another 100 megs of my RAM, and I just want to. I would probably not give the person at Apple that made that decision a hug. That's the one I would say.
I mean, there's things you can do about it, given time, but not all those problems are solvable in the time that you have. And you know, this is one of the things that's always kind of a problem with using a game engine. I think we've talked about this a couple times before. Is using a game engine makes like a bunch of stuff way easier than not using a game engine, but then it makes some stuff impossible, right? And some of the tech choices for something like Unreal are not actually the perfect ones for particularly for a device that's all flash memory, right?
Yeah.
There's things that you could do if you're saying we're going to just write like an iPad only game engine from scratch of keep all your resources on disk in usable format and just mmap them in off mm-hmm. the flash and mm-hmm. and use them in place. And the Unreal Engine just isn't set up to do that. Like it would be crazy for them. They've got like six other platforms to support. And
a lot of those platforms run off of CDs or DVDs,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
And DVD yep. memory loading is like orders of magnitude different than off of an iPad. And yep. so it's just a totally different...
It's set up for level streaming and LOD very well, but it's like we actually lost 6 months of production of iOS 7 coming out and you chewing up all of our resources. And we had a game that ran fine and iOS 7 just broke it. And we've literally spent half a year, adding load screens, like managing content. Yeah. It's been very frustrating. So we were going to ship last week and we had a couple more bugs to iron out for the 4S. So yeah, I think you're really right about being an albatross and will be for a long time.
But you have the engine that lets you do cinematic stuff.
It's so true. It's true.
It gives and it takes.
It does.
And so there's always a trade-off. There's never any one right answer.
No,
right?
There's not. Yeah. I mean, that's engineering. Engineering is trade-offs. So,
for sure.
Yeah.
The best possible answer with the worst scenario.
We do. We talk all the time about the best bad option that we have.
Yeah. So. Yeah, what's the least bad?
Yeah.